All right, welcome everybody to the Safe Trek UCTC Friday seminar. Today we've got Ryan Green-Rosell speaking. Ryan's a senior transportation planner at the San Francisco County Transportation Authority with experience in performance measurement and policy analysis applied to road safety. She was the lead researcher for NCHRP 1746, a comprehensive analysis framework for safety investment decisions, which involves developing methods to compare engineering, enforcement, and education-based safety strategies. She formerly worked at Cambridge Systematics and at SafeTrek, where she helped author a guidebook for Caltrans on measuring pedestrian exposure to collisions. So before Ryan gets started, we're going to have everybody in the room go around and introduce themselves, just so that we all know who we are, and then we'll get on to the presentation.
Hello, I'm Phyllis Auric. I work at SafeTrek.
And I'm Tony Kane. I'm a journalist at Albany Patch. I visit university events that might be of interest.
I'm Arthur Grambeck, Associate Director for Research at SafeTrek.
I'm Frank Prim, a graduate student researcher here at SafeTrek.
Ryan Green-Rosell of County Transportation Authority.
I'm
John Bigham.
I'm a researcher here. I am Tanya Ong, Application Programmer at SafeTrek.
Great. Cool. Well, thank you all so much for coming this afternoon and listening. I appreciate it. Great to be here. As Frank said, I was a researcher here long ago, so it's always nice to come back and visit. And I actually did was remembering that I came a couple years ago and talk about this research when it was in its early stages. And I think John was there, I think Oprah was there. So this is that's when we were still struggling with it. My part in it is now over because I've moved on to another job, but this research is actually ongoing, and CHRP 1746 Cambridge Systematics continues to lead it, and there's a phase two. So, and I think when I was here last, I was sort of, I remember feeling nervous because we were still in that stage of the research where you sort of are in a panic and don't know how you're going to get through it. And this was one I wonder if any of you have experienced this in terms of when you apply for a grant. And struggle with the application and then are sort of excited to submit it but a little fearful that you might actually be selected. that may have happened to some of you in the past, and this was definitely one of those I struggled with. It was a very strange research statement. I really couldn't understand what they were asking for, and we wrote a proposal and were selected, and thus followed about a year of struggle and panic trying to figure out what the heck we were doing and how to answer their question. And because the question that seemed to be posed, it was a very short research statement, fundamentally a little confusing, because it asked about how can we come up with an investment decision-making framework that includes all four E's of safety, so all the engineering, enforcement, emergency response. And we, you know, On a certain level, that makes great sense. We want to prioritize what's most cost-effective. I think any form of government and public spending, we want to focus on what's most cost-effective. So it makes sense to have, a methodology and investment decision-making framework to focus on what's most cost-effective. But within safety, as I'm sure a lot of you are aware, the funding sources are very siloed, and the people who do these different E's of safety are very, very separate from one another. So what we struggled with was, okay, sure, we can do this work, but how is it going to be applied? And a lot of NCHRP research is supposed to be, applied research, because at the end of the day, you still have your highway safety money going. Some of it goes to the DOT, some of it goes to the safety organization. They have their own prioritization processes. They have their own skill sets. And we didn't really see it as an either-or, that, you would either do engineering or behavioral safety. Typically, you do packages of them that can even be complementary. So, but what it seemed like we were being asked for, and when we met with the panel, they confirmed that they did want a process that would show whether, in a certain instance, behavioral safety measures are more cost-effective than engineering and vice versa. So they wanted us to try to come up with a method that could answer that question. So, We set out to do that, and I think what we came to understand is that the panel recognized that this was really getting out ahead of where we are with funding, but in the anticipation and the hope that in the future our safety funding will become more flexible and we'll be able to create safety plans that are have analysis and really show what's the most cost-effective package of investments that we can do, regardless of the funding stream and regardless of the kind of investment. And also just note as I go through this that I have very few PowerPoint slides. I'm trying to adopt a new style of PowerPoint where I just don't use slides and I just talk to people. just surprise, surprise. It's actually a little more challenging, but I'm trying to do that. So if I only have like 5 slides, so if you keep waiting for me to show you my slides, you'll be waiting a long time. I'm just going to tell you, attempt to tell you what I want to communicate. So that's kind of an introduction to the research purpose, which was the purpose we were given was to come up with a method that would help rank or prioritize different types of safety investments. So we spent a while trying to struggle with and figure out what we were going to do, but we actually did come up with 2 methods. One of them, we just called them a qualitative and a quantitative method. Both of them kind of use elements of qualitative and quantitative, but what I'm going to focus on today is the quantitative method. The qualitative method was really a scoring system that we helped could demonstrate which, you know, types of projects, like sort of in the vein of high, medium, low scoring system that would help identify, you know, the quality of the research behind the effectiveness of different types of countermeasures, so you could more quickly go through a process and identify which countermeasures are more likely to be cost-effective. And we ended up calling it sort of a visualization, or what I like to refer to as the bubbles, or the blue base, which I think I have the bubbles here. This is the results of the qualitative approach. And if you have extra time at the end of the talk, I can discuss this. But what I wanted to talk about today was our effort to do a quantitative analysis of the benefits and costs of engineering education and enforcement safety countermeasures. And focusing on quantitative because I think this audience probably has the most appetite for that kind of thing. So this just at a high level, this is really impossible to read, so not even worth it, but this is our process. So there's a number of steps involved in comparing the benefits and costs of safety countermeasures, and on the left is a sort of an overview of the qualitative process, and on the right is an overview of the quantitative. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to go through the steps in the quantitative process and show how we applied it and show the assumptions that we had to make along the way. And I think the points that I want to try to get across are, first of all, that, you know, this is possible. You can do it. You can make this kind of comparison, but there are a lot of assumptions that you have to make. Part of the purpose, I think, is just to show the kinds of assumptions that you have to make and to demonstrate a real need for additional research to inform those assumptions, because the assumptions are very thin in many, many cases. There's very little to go on. So that's one point, is just, you know, you can do this. I do think it can be a valuable exercise to help, you know, try to put all these different kinds of countermeasures on a level playing field and does, you know, take a step in that direction towards empirically based method of identifying the most effective countermeasures. So I think it's a step in a positive direction and also helps demonstrate where we need research and research gaps, which is great for you guys because you're researchers and I'm sure always looking for research ideas. And this project was very well funded. I was very surprised. It was went in for a second round of funding and it got been funded up to $1 million. So among this group of people, there was a lot of interest in this particular topic. So maybe there's more research opportunities. So I think that's one thing to kind of think about as I go through. And I'm also interested in hearing from you guys. I did this research, you know, we had a small research team, but a lot of this was kind of in my head, and I didn't have a lot of, our panel was not composed of safety experts. They were DOT staff who, you know, don't have academic background in safety, so I never really received a lot of feedback from an academic audience who pays attention to the details. So I'm curious what you would have done if posed this question. Would you have made different assumptions? Would you have approached this differently? Very curious about your feedback on that. Okay, so to get into it, first of all, I think, I talked about the two methods. What we had to do first was, we wanted to do, as an exercise, a quantitative cost comparison. First, we needed to identify a location and a group of interested people who could give us data, and we hoped that the analysis could be relevant to some kind of planning process that we were doing. We had to do the analysis for the purposes of this research, but we wanted, ideally, for it to have usefulness beyond just an academic exercise. So, because we're near San Francisco, this was before I worked for the county, but I went, and they have, for several years, some of you may know, have been in the process of doing a pedestrian safety analysis and prioritization process. Megan Mitten's been really involved in that. They're in the process of doing strategic planning for pedestrian safety, and I identified a number of high-injury corridors. I think I have a little map. That process is still ongoing, by the way. This is very recent. But this shows the very long line across the top is Geary Boulevard. I'm sure some of you have been out on Geary Boulevard in San Francisco. Have some of you, maybe, been up to Fillmore, perhaps? So Geary was one of the high-injury corridors. That was one that they had a lot of data for and were interested in, sort of learning more about, doing more exploration. They had already done some crash data analysis. And there's also the BRT project plan for Geary, as some of you know. So maybe an opportunity to do more along that corridor. So we felt like, okay, here's an opportunity where it seems somewhat relevant to a planning process. So that's why we selected San Francisco and also Geary as well. Because remember, we have to compare engineering, enforcement, and education. So for engineering, we need a location. So we could have said, let's do engineering measures through the whole city of San Francisco and make some assumptions about, okay, what if we do, a big program of pedestrian medians everywhere in San Francisco. What would that, what would the benefit be? But we didn't. Instead, we actually ended up choosing different scales for the countermeasures. So we selected four countermeasures, pictures representing them. So on the top left is automated enforcement. We're just talking about automated enforcement. We chose that. Calling that enforcement, although, some people call it engineering because it's site-specific, you do it in a specific location. Automated enforcement, pedestrian median extension, that's meant to be the top left. Along Geary, there are some medians, but they don't have noses, and they don't kind of extend out and provide full protection to pedestrians. So pedestrian median extension, the bottom right is Safe Routes to Schools program, so pedestrian safety programs to in schools to improve child pedestrian safety, and then DUI checkpoints as well. So why did these represented at least three of the E's of safety. And so why did we choose these countermeasures? Well, one was we needed, for this exercise, we needed to cover multiple E's. We felt for this to be quantitative, we had to choose countermeasures where there's some quantitative information on their effectiveness. And for behavioral safety measures in particular, there's just, the list is pretty short. So we chose based in part on the availability of information, and then in part because these countermeasures had been, in some of the prior research that I mentioned, had been discussed as being appropriate either for Geary or, for San Francisco as a whole. So those are the reasons we chose these countermeasures. So what I want to do now is just talk through each of the countermeasures and the assumptions that we made, again, just to demonstrate what we had to do in order to be able to compare the costs and benefits over, an equivalent, you don't actually need an equivalent time period, but that's the advantage of benefit cost analysis, but you need to be able to say what are the costs and what are the benefits over what time period, and then you can compare all those. You have to define all those things for each countermeasure. So, let's see. To start off with, I can talk about the median. Pedestrian median extension. So, again, we chose those because that was something that came up a couple times. This would be good for the Geary corridor. When I went into it, I thought, I think we have crash reduction factors for median. Looking into the details, we don't really have anything for median extension. We have Charlie Goodyear's work, which is, what are the benefits of median in an uncontrolled crossing where they didn't exist before. That seems to be the most closest available. Yeah.
The median extension.
not really super applicable, and it's very high. I think it's about 46%. I was just looking at my paper, but 46% reduction in pedestrian crashes for pedestrian vehicles. So, again, not a very perfect use of that CMF, but that's what we had, so we used it. that was one of them. And for each of these, you need to define define the countermeasure, define where it's going to be in order to define the cost. And a lot of these questions are interconnected, so you need to know the cost, you need to know geography, which can be connected to the cost, right? So, like, the level of deployment, am I going to do this in 5 locations, 10 locations, 20 locations, the effectiveness, which we already talked about, and then the duration, how long is it going to be effective, how long is it going to affect crashes, and those are the main things, and then to be able to say what population of crashes is this going to affect. All those questions are actually interconnected, but the pedestrian median extensions were in some ways the most straightforward because they have a pretty defined geography. You just said, well, we're just going to do this along a high interest corridor segment along here in 10 locations. So we could say, we had a cost estimate for what it would take to extend the median, just multiply that by the number of locations. We had information about the number of pedestrian crashes per intersection along that segment, so we were able to use that. For the duration of effectiveness, for a lot of capital engineering investments, frequently assume that they're effective for 20 years, 10 to 20 years, nobody knows for sure, but you put them, if it's pavement, it lasts a while. And so we assume that they were effective for 20 years. We did not include any maintenance costs, which now that I work in the city of San Francisco, I look at the cost assumptions that I made, they were very way too low for this. So. Everything costs way more than you would ever think, and don't forget the maintenance costs because it actually is. So, especially if it's a landscape median, those kinds of things. So you have to make all of these assumptions have a big effect, and that's part of what I'm trying to demonstrate. But so that this one was relatively straightforward. You have your duration of effectiveness, you have your locations, your cost, the number of pedestrian crashes occurring at those locations. So that one was fairly straightforward. The next one that I could talk about are the cameras. So if you see in a little square, a green square, that's the automated indication. So for this one, we were thinking, okay, what assumption do we make? Automated speed enforcement is new. It's something a lot of people have talked about in San Francisco. It's something a lot of people want to do. And in fact, this Rajiv Bhatia and Megan Vera at the CPH were co-authors on this. In part because they wanted to show that automated speed enforcement was part of their interest in it, because it's something that they pursued for San Francisco. You can't actually implement it right now because of legal issues, but they thought, okay, let's do something where we propose it as a pilot for the city. And so we said, okay, well, what if we did a pilot along Geary? And I made some assumptions about, we found information about the typical cost of cameras per year as you lease the cameras, which should include the operating costs. And then there are a number of studies about the effectiveness of speed enforcement, so we could get a crash reduction factor from those. However, the actual population of crashes affected was harder to define. So a lot of these studies have documented that clearly you don't just affect the crashes at the intersections where you do enforce, but you affect them within some area. So what is that area? Is it the whole city of San Francisco? Is it small area? So for this one, I went through and reviewed as many of these studies as I could and looked at, within what buffer did they document some kind of crash reduction. And this is also quite tricky because, to really do that right, you'd have to do it at like many, many distances and see where it falls off. It's probably like a declining curve. But in a lot of the studies, they just decide to measure it. We're just going to measure it within, half a mile. We're going to measure it within a mile on either side. So essentially, I looked at all those studies, and I just made an assumption that it would affect crashes within half a mile before. So that was one assumption that was based on studies, but again, has a pretty big impact on the system calculations. The other big assumption you have to make for this one is, and that you'll see for all the other ones, is sort of what I like to call the dose response curve effect, which a lot of people in public health think about, is like how much investment do we need to get the effect that we desire, that we see in the research. So drawing on all these studies, they need a certain level of investment, they saw certain crash reductions, but was that level of investment, you know, was that the minimum necessary to achieve the reduction? Was it more than enough? How many cameras are necessary to achieve an the kinds of reductions we see in the literature? So that was a big question going into it. Initially, I just made an assumption, but then realized that that assumption was so important that I went back and tried to, again, review multiple studies, look at how many cameras they used over what area and what crash reduction effect they achieved given that investment in cameras, and then made an assumption that we needed two cameras to achieve, I think it was a 20% reduction in this buffer area. So any questions so far? Silver's looking very thoughtful. Next question? I think he reviewed some of the initial work, but didn't work with him closely. Well, it was we drew on Steve. We used Steve's information.
This is speed enforcement.
Yeah.
I had thought they were usually used in freeway kind of situation.
They are usually. Yeah.
Gary,
it can be. Yeah, and I know speeding is an issue on Gary. So, to be honest, I didn't think through a lot of the mechanics of how that would work.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do speed enforcement on an urban arterial?
The CMF used theirs for speed enforcement in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. So,
and there's a larger question of, like, are these CMFs really applicable to this environment
right. At
all? I mean, certainly the pedestrian one is very questionable. I pointed that out several times in the research, but, you know, if there isn't another one that I know of. You're using research that where they made a certain level of investment and got a certain result, and it's unknown as to whether that would apply.
For the level of investment, you're using the number of intersections that are instrumented?
I use the number of cameras. Yeah.
Which is similar probably to the number of intersections?
Yeah, right. Although you could move them, some of them are mobile. So you can move them around.
And are the CMFs from a defined at a comparable level? It's used probably from different states.
Yeah, right.
So there's also a question about the level of fine. Or comparable level of funding.
Yes, right. No, that's a good point, too. Yeah. Like, what kind of level?
A little bit of
the question was that it was really more of a comment that the effectiveness of the cameras could vary depending on the amount of the fund.
Right.
So,
right.
And no, I didn't look at that at all, actually.
Right.
So, challenges, right? All challenges. That's why one of my questions is, what would you have done? So that was the cameras. So those are some of the things that struggle with the cameras. For the pedestrian safety training, for that, there's the other two, the safety training and the DOI checkpoints, we assumed that those would be sort of implemented. We didn't define a geography. We defined a level of investment for those and assumed they could be really anywhere in the city. So for the pedestrian safety training, we assumed, you know, some increase in the number of schools that would receive training. Some of them are already receiving training. And there was information available on the typical costs. And those are actually San Francisco costs, of what it costs to run a pedestrian safety training program. But we didn't have San Francisco effectiveness information for that. We drew for all of these on national studies, primarily documented in the future pieces 22. That was one of the effectiveness of behavioral safety countermeasures. It's one of the...
Say it again, NCHR.
622 is the effectiveness of behavioral safety countermeasures. So that's where we got a number for the DUI checkpoints and the school safety training program. So for school safety, for those two, you know, same situation, you have to know something about the cost, something about ideally you would have information about whether the costs are sufficient to produce the result that you've seen elsewhere. We didn't really know, so we made the assumption that, you know, the safety program in San Francisco would, you know, continuation of that would achieve the results seen elsewhere, and for DUI checkpoints for that one, I think I need to refer back to the paper, but I think we drew from checkpoint programs implemented across pretty large geographic areas, and they tried to saturate the whole area, and the cost was based on a cost per population. So just assume the same cost per population inflated to today's dollars. Didn't account for the fact that everything is going to be more expensive, of course, than everywhere else. probably should have. So ideally for this, again, like, it's kind of illustrating this, an issue where the quality of your assumptions is really important, but to get good assumptions takes, you know, a lot of time and investment. So if we wanted to spend the time, we could have tried to get costs for what DUI checkpoints actually cost in San Francisco, which I didn't try to get. And there may be some local information about the effectiveness of DUI checkpoints. The other issue that you have to deal with these two in particular is how long, if you're doing enforcement and training, how long does the benefit last? And that has a huge impact on your results as well.
And that's a big deal for behavioral.
In general, right. It's something that people struggle with. We need a lot more research on. We did for this just decide, okay, we need to do a lit review and see what kind of information is out there on how, you know, have we done studies to look at the duration of effects for these programs. And we did find, there have been studies of DUI checkpoints that we were able to find with some varying results, but it will be available with the report for this study, not in my particular paper, but we did a short lit review and showed that seemed like a fairly reasonable conservative assumption to say that if you fund DUI checkpoints in 1 year, you could see the effects for the following 2 years. That was the assumption we made for these, so that you would you'd fund 1 year but get 3 years of benefit. That was the assumption we made for DUI checkpoints. For the pedestrian safety training, I couldn't find any research showing that the programs have long-term benefits. It's entirely possible that they do, and it's entirely possible that they have benefits that could last a person's lifetime, but I could not find research to demonstrate that. So we assumed that the program was only beneficial while it was funded, and that really, of course, cuts down on the benefits of the program. Maybe that's not a fair assumption, but again, it's just, to me, points to the need for, ideally, we need better ways of making these assumptions or more research to inform them. The other tricky thing about these two is, again, the geographic issue. We define the benefits as accruing over the whole city of San Francisco. So for DUI checkpoints, we applied the crash reduction factor to all alcohol-involved crashes in San Francisco. For pedestrian safety training, we applied the crash reduction factor to all crashes involving child pedestrians in San Francisco, but taking only the proportion, sort of the proportion that is equivalent to the proportion of schools that would be affected by the program, so sort of assuming we would target a certain share of the child population and that proportion applies to the share of child-involved pedestrian crashes. But, of course, that's not entirely true. Like, children can leave San Francisco and cars can drive elsewhere. With any behavioral safety measure, it could accrue over. It's very difficult to connect it to the geography. Maybe for children a little easier because, you know, they're probably primarily walking within San Francisco, I would think. But for driving, I mean, DUI checkpoints, that could go all over the region. So I think it's harder to make those kinds of assumptions. But couldn't see a way around making them to make this kind of assumption. So let's see. So I think I've talked to you about all of the issues. Yeah, just a final thought on the cost. For some of these are also, you know, the issues can be kind of nuanced, like for automated speed enforcement, it could actually bring in revenue. So you have to, I mean, in good benefit-cost analysis, I think you really have to carefully define, like, benefits for whom and costs for whom and try to match those things well. We assume the cost is, the cost to the public agency is any revenue. There's also, of course, a political cost to some of these. I know UI checkpoints can be not as easily attractive. Also, of course, automated speed enforcement is currently not possible in San Francisco and very politically controversial, so may have low costs but high barriers. So ideally, and a lot of behavioral safety measures are like that, like particularly legislative change. I mean, you could look at the cost to, if you're trying to quantify the cost of like a statewide legislative change that you know has a huge benefit, you know, you could look at the operating cost of enforcing the new law, but there's also a cost of political campaigning. You could potentially invest the cost and see no benefit if it doesn't pass. So those are just a lot of the challenges that go into quantifying the benefits of laws and enforcement of behavior change. So I can show you the results. There they are. Ta-da. Very dramatic. So what you see on this is that school pedestrian training programs didn't come out very well because, well, like I said, because we assume that the cost you have to spend on it every year and that it applies to a pretty small base. You're looking just at pedestrian crashes involving children who are in grade school. That's not a very big number. So you get a pretty small base that you're applying the benefit to. And in fact, the crash reduction factors were also pretty low for this program. All of these ended up being a positive benefit cost ratio. So, speech cameras looked the best because they had, we showed them affecting a high, pretty large geographic area. A lot of crashes occur in that area, and the costs are relatively low to lease the cameras. Sobriety checkpoints are kind of in the middle, relatively low cost, and like I said, we applied the base with the whole city of San Francisco, alcohol and box crashes, so pretty high base. And the median extensions looked good because, really primarily because the duration is so long, you make a one-time investment, but then you're saying you get that, that one cost is divided over 20 years, and I, did not include maintenance costs, which now I wish I had. So, so that was the result. And of course, now that this is done, I'm full of ideas about how I could have done it better. Principally, I wish that I had done the whole, or we had, I should say, because this is a team effort, had done this as a sensitivity analysis and really showed a range of results for everything. Mm. I think it's misleading to put a dot on this graph because it's really a range. There were also a couple of assumptions that I think would have been really benefited from more information. We tried hard to get as good of information as we could, but some of them, the information was pretty weak. So I think doing a range would be really more appropriate for this kind of thing. So that was one takeaway for me. It's kind of one of these things. With any modeling exercise, any analysis exercise, the quality of your results is largely, a function of the quality of the inputs that you put in. So you really have to spend the time putting together some good assumptions and documenting them. So those were some of my takeaways from it. On the positive side, like I said, I hadn't seen a lot of this kind of thing done before. I think it's good to start in the direction of trying to do this kind of analysis so we show that, push the state of the practice towards more use of cost-effectiveness information, more effort to find out what's the cost-effective use of public funds. Because in some cases, the behavioral safety measures suffer because there's quite a few more assumptions you have to make in order to show that they're cost-effective. And, I think there are fewer attempts to do that kind of analysis and compare it to engineering. So, and this, like I said, the audience for this was an NCHRP panel made up primarily of a couple of forward-thinking DOT state safety engineers who realize that they get a lot of the money, but it may be that the kind of safety investments they're making are not as cost-effective as what could be done with behavioral safety measures. So they're really progressive in thinking about how can we level the playing field, how can we focus our resources on what's cost-effective. So that concludes my talking. I'd like to hear from you guys about, do you have any comments or thoughts on this? Would you have done it? Would you approach this question differently if I hadn't shown you all this and just given you the question? What might you have done differently, and what do you think about the applicability of this, you know, to the practice? You know, what would we need to take this to the next level, et cetera, et cetera. So,
The sizes of the and the colors of the circle could either represent the actual benefit cost ratio.
Yes, that's right.
The colors.
I think they're not coming out very well, but they're supposed to signify just a different education, engineering, enforcement. Although maybe they don't mean. Now that I'm looking at this more closely, I don't. I guess it depends how you classify speed cameras, but I don't think
the
color
size
really
is the actual.
The size is the ratio, yeah, that's right.
One thing mm-hmm. that I was wondering about is with the speed cameras, you said you have this assumption that the effect will be within a half mile
mm-hmm.
buffer. Is that,
yeah.
What's the basis for that? Because my thinking would be if drivers know that a speed camera is on a given corridor,
mm-hmm.
they're only going to respond to it on that corridor.
I would have to look into that question, but my assumption is that there's something about something psychological that happens where if you know that you're in an area or you see a speed camera and you slow down because of it, that you just, within a certain area, you've just kind of changed your behavior and would resume that behavior. That's a good question. I think also, you know, some of these studies did move the cameras around a little bit too, so then people may think, well, it's here, but there could also be one on a couple streets over if they're moving around, and I think that those are probably more effective when you move the cameras. But I do think that, yeah, if you've slowed down once, it's reasonable that you would sort of continue that behavior for some amount of time before, you know, moving on to, you know, some other area where you're going to be seeing it. So.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Slow down. Get to it, and right after, you get the gas. So that's why the police office, they also like try to catch that kind of thing by hiding themselves after this camera, and then they use their manual shot.
Okay.
Check
the speed. They literally speed up after they pass the camera?
Yes.
Okay, so that would definitely negate the claim I just made. Interesting.
Well,
but you're talking about
the
specific distance from that, right? Not
mm-hmm.
necessarily the whole city.
Right.
The half a mile might still be reasonable.
But the
question I have is that, do you consider every collision inside of the buffer, or only consider collision occurred because of high speed?
So we did at all collisions inside the buffer because there were, actually for speed enforcement, there were a range of CMS available, some of them just for speed involved and some of them for all crashes. And the speed involved are higher, obviously, because if you're applying them to a smaller date. We ended up choosing the all crashes in part because we didn't have good information on the speed crashes within the buffer.
One idea, though, is that whole idea of general deterrence, where you
mm-hmm.
make everybody know there are
speed
cameras.
Right.
And
that's maybe kind of what I was getting at.
Yeah. And then the other problem is, when they're effective, your revenue drops. So a lot of places have had to stop them because they can't pay the rent because they're not getting any tickets. And aside from the politics of it, it's,
interesting.
You know, yeah.
Interesting.
And same with the UI. I mean, we administer the sobriety checkpoint programs, and part of the deal is you issue press releases several days before them saying generally where they're going to be and when they're going to be.
Yeah.
So that people, you hope, will not drive.
And after a while,
a successful checkpoint catches known drunk drivers.
I see. Right. Interesting.
And that's very hard for the public to understand, and that's hard for the funders to understand, which is why I think they have this money coming in from the feds to say, yes, we'll fund this, even though we hope you don't catch anybody. We hope no one's driving to you. But you're right about the duration. That's a really good question. This is not in your study, but this time around, I would be curious to replace speed cameras with speed feedback signs. And I don't know if there's literature about that, but that's much more appropriate. You see it more often on arterials and residential streets and feeders. So I myself am skeptical about them, it might be interesting to see.
To look at, And incidentally, San Francisco has just applied for a major NHTSA grant to do speed enforcement on high injury corridors, licenses and series. So not with automated enforcement, but it would probably just involve officer over time. But maybe there's possibility of considering that kind of thing as part of the two.
Well, that would be a nice natural experiment then. Right?
Yeah, definitely.
So first of all, yes, this is indeed very, very challenging. and the assumptions that you made are all defendable.
Yeah.
And they all make sense. I agree with you that doing a sensitivity analysis would add a lot more light on what we can learn from that, because it may, well, it would be interesting to see how sensitive it is to the assumptions.
Yes.
And we have to work with what is available out there. My question is, it seems that the approach was to use engineering cost benefit analysis as the benchmark, and then to try and do something similar for education or enforcement. And my impression is that the biggest challenge to try and quantify the benefit cost for education and enforcement is more the question of, okay, how does it change over space and time? What is the range?
Yeah.
With respect to space, what is the range with respect to time? And of course, for engineering, it's very specific.
Right.
There's a specific, it's specific in space and in time, and you can easily project, okay, this is going to be for 20 years.
Yeah.
So my question is, what have you learned from this process about what additional information we need, or what are the things we need to think about when we're implementing enforcement or education countermeasure? What are the things that we need to think about that would then help us refine the assumptions about what is the effectiveness of this over space and time?
That's a very good question. I'd have to think about it. I think maybe it points to a need for a slightly different evaluation methodology for some of those. Like you said, Philip, like this general return theory, perhaps, you could test that for a specific population. Like if you did a statistically representative sample in San Francisco, you did a DUI, press release for San Francisco, and then you did a sample of, you don't evaluate the program based on how many people you catch, but you evaluate it based on, maybe a survey responses. I don't know how you would get at it, but some kind of statistically valid approach to determine whether the deterrent effect is occurring in San Francisco for that population, and so then you can, and perhaps you would need to do it so that you could segment by different geographies and look at how those the location of the checkpoints affected the deterrent effect for how it impacted the deterrent effect for different geographies. I mean, I assume for all these things, sort of like a declining curve of influence, but if you could get better defined where this, set up a survey that would allow you to define where the effect really drops off, that would be, geographically, that would be very helpful,
And probably over time also.
Yes, and over time, definitely. And to keep doing it until you see no effect, because I think for some of the duration of effect research we're looking at, they would do, say, a lot of them I remember were for these alcohol intervention programs where they would go and meet with people who were repeat DUI offenders, and then they would follow up with them 2 years later, and the effect was still there, and that was the end of the study. And ideally, you'd keep going back so that you would know, what years, or do it for quite a few years, that you'd know how does the effect follow up over time. So it's that space, knowing where to draw that line for space and time to really capture the full effect.
Yeah, because a lot of the challenges for education and enforcement is that most of these applications, they commonly don't measure the effectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And usually if they do, then they would just measure the effectiveness of something very specific, and they would provide information about what we did and what was the effectiveness. But as you said, that may not necessarily be usable for future studies and future applications like yours, because that's not enough input into this model, so then you add more assumptions. So there may be room to develop some guidelines of how to evaluate education enforcement efforts, so that then it would bring us probably closer to being able to quantify that and contrast your dose response, or maybe minimal dose.
Yes.
So that is something that is also very important, because if someone wants to do some, I think there's no guidelines today, if you want to do some education program, no one tells you, okay, how much effort you need to put in to show an effect.
Yes, exactly.
So you may not even be, so that's good to know before.
Yes.
So this is how much I need, as opposed to, okay, we just have a little amount of money, let's do some education.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Well, and we encountered that, we've done two evaluations of Safe Routes to School, you know, and I think very similar problems that you had.
Yeah.
In not a lot of data to work with, not consistency across sites.
Yeah.
Time, not consistently across time.
Yes.
The school population, as you know, is evanescent.
Yes.
Time has been changing. So I think that would be, if there would be almost like a basis, just at least like what you almost did, except for guidelines. Just, well, here's something that you can start with that you could have something to compare your, you know.
Yeah. It also maybe makes me think that you, I think, guidelines, absolutely, and just like simple, I mean, I know that given the level of the people I was working with, like their appetite for this kind of detail was very limited.
Mm-hmm.
And engineers are like, give me my lookup table, you know, and, you know, where you could say, and you know, it's possible you could start building that for, if you have some information on these programs to say, like, a reasonable assumption for a duration of effectiveness for DUI programs is X number of years, and this is based on XYZ, and that's what we have for this other program, we don't have anything, and just to kind of lay it out in a simple fashion, I think would be very valuable. And, you know, it also does make me think, though, over, like, that you almost, like, could we use a somewhat different paradigm for behavioral, I'm just kind of thinking on the leading edge here, but a lot of behavioral and educational efforts apply to people, not places. So if you could almost do something like look at your population and how sort of well-behaved your population is, and then say, like, these are the crash outcomes associated with your population being sort of at different levels of, for lack of a better term right now, well, you know, having good safety behaviors, almost like with level of service and safety, you know, work where you do for roadways, where you say this roadway is like performing above what we'd expect. And this population in San Francisco is like safer than the typical population. And if we do this behavioral safety program, like we can get, you know, this subgroup of our population moved up, and then they're going to like, you know, our population will continue, you know, and then that will hopefully persist if you can have persistent behavioral change. And then you could just fundamentally, like, have a better behaved population that has fewer risky travel behavior. So, I don't know, maybe you need a different,
so
I'm kind of thinking
about
of,
maybe that serving the population in some
way,
and then you can actually quantify how a certain program changed that safety climate or safety culture.
The
of
safety culture,
And then maybe, try to look for associations between the level of safety climate or culture and crashes, so as another.
And also to have it be comparable across, like, locations, because then you could say, well, in San Francisco, like, we have X, you know, certain prevalence of behaviors and attitudes in our, you know, area, and that leads to certain crash outcomes, and, you know, you could compare it to other locations.
Good drivers versus the bad drivers. I understand that there's various differences within the group and also between the groups, and just looking for that piece that also really not specifically in the countermeasure.
Yeah, definitely.
There's something there innate that would affect that.
Yeah, no, and I'm sure there's demographic, you know, for a given population demographic, you probably expect certain behaviors. And, you know, that's where, like, maybe the level of service and safety thing concept could apply, too.
That's like one of the three emphasis areas on the new Strategic Highway Safety Program and safety culture.
Yeah.
So there's a really, and there's a subgroup that's really interested in trying to address that and work on that. And again, you'd want a baseline.
Yeah.
So it's not just flailing in the dark. You know, some way to establish a baseline to at least get a sense of what are we talking about.
Yeah. I know we're almost out of time, but also just wanted to note that there is another NCTRP project, and I forget the number, that seems to be somewhat contradictory with this one. That's never happened before, I'm sure. but it's called, it's something about cost-benefit analysis for behavioral safety countermeasures. It came out maybe a year or so, the RFP came out while we were in the midst of this, and there just seems to be a little overlap, but the idea was to continue to advance the research information available to do cost-benefit analysis for behavioral safety. So I believe it was HDR leading that effort. I haven't looked into it, but that's just something that I want to look out for and just to be aware of that there is another NCTRP project. I haven't seen any results from it yet, but that's looking at some of these issues. So.
622.
All
right.
Cool. I think we'll cut the recording there. And thank you, Ryan, for talking.
Thank you. Bye.